Hello, it's Danny Chambers here, one of the founders of Vet Voices. And on this episode of the Vet Voices podcast, we've got Mike Davies, who's an RCVS specialist in nutrition. Mike, would you like to introduce yourself? And because you work primarily in nutrition now, don't you? You used to be in practice and you used to teach at universities, but you're now...
Yeah, currently I'm working pretty much 100% in the area of clinical nutrition, giving clinical advice and also as a consultant to companies and so on. But I started life in practice. I had my own practice for 12 years. I did a couple of certificates there in radiology and swine orthopedics. I then went on and worked for Hill's Pet Nutrition as a director of scientific affairs when they launched into Europe. And after that, I went to the Royal Veterinary College, where I was director of the Beaumont Animal Hospital and head of information services. And whilst I was there, I did a diploma in swine clinical nutrition run by the Royal College, and I've held that for a number of years. I've also worked in the pharmaceutical industry for Fort Dodge full-time as tech service manager and later for Pfizer. And I've worked actually for most of the big pharmaceutical companies in one way or another as a consultant, either in nutrition or in geriatrics, which was one of my other main interests. And a lot of the scientific studies I've published over the years have been in geriatric arena as well as clinical nutrition.
So that's quite an impressive array of experience across a whole variety of different sectors of the veterinary industry. So to talking about nutrition, I guess as someone who's in first opinion practice, my main job is horses, but I do quite a lot of small animal locuming as well. When it comes to small animal work, I guess obesity is one of the biggest things that we see on a day-to-day basis, or at least diseases relating to obesity, everything from arthritis being made worse to heart disease to diabetes, as well as just carrying a bit too much weight in an otherwise healthy dog. How much of that is down to nutrition? And I say that in a it sounds like an obvious question, but but it's not just about eating too much, is it? It's about the type of balanced diet that you can be obese and you can also be malnourished, can you?
Well, you can actually be obese and be super fit as well. In America, there's a human group called Association of Obese Athletes, and they run marathons every weekend. So being overweight isn't necessarily bringing with it just the negative factors, but we do know there are so many negative things associated with obesity now, you know, this chronic inflammatory situation that animals are in all the time and so on, and also its effect on in particular in cats on precipitating diabetes. So there's no question that obesity is the number one nutritional disorder that we see. The bottom line is simply that they are eating too many calories compared to what they're utilizing. And that sounds easy to say, and it is simple, but there are genetic factors involved as well. In humans, there are some women who are genetically predisposed to be obese, and they cannot reduce their calorie requirements to get weight off without becoming nutritionally deficient. So they have a really serious genetic predisposition which they cannot overcome just by modifying dietary intake or by increasing exercise. So the problems we've got is there's several main points to this. One is feeding guides on pet food labels are very much a guideline. They're not carved in stone. So for an animal of a certain metabolic size, which is then converted into a body weight, there are lots of variables that mean that one individual of the same size may require less or more calories to maintain itself. And there is the problem, because if owners just follow the feeding guide religiously, in many cases, they're going to be giving far too many calories to the animal.
And if you have an idea of how many, like what proportion of dogs in the UK are overweight?
Well, the figures vary, but usually we're talking about between 40 and 60% of dogs are overweight. But that doesn't mean they're clinically obese. So the obese section is lower than that. But still, it's a major contributor to secondary disorders and metabolic changes, which we know are all negative. There's almost nothing positive about being in an obese state unless you happen to be starved for a while. But even then, the reserves you've got can be detrimental, especially if you're a cat, because you know we can get massive mobilization of fat if a cat stops eating, and that can cause hepatic lipidosis, which can be fatal. So there's nothing to be said that's positive about being obese in an obese state.
So you mentioned before about how different individual dogs of the same size may have very different energy requirements. Is that purely just difference between individuals genetically, or do certain breeds have certain predisposed to being either more or less energy requirements?
Yeah, clearly it is a genetic problem partially, it's nutritional intake partially, and it's also owner behavior. So if an owner has a bowl which is a certain size, they like their animal to eat, they like their animal to be seen to be enjoying its food, and they will invariably fill the bowl. Well, you know, if you look at some of the cat bowls I've seen, where they've got a cat which really has got quite a limited, you know, gastric size in terms of food it can actually eat, they will always overfeed those animals if they're putting the food into a bowl which is too big to contain just what the animal requires. So it's a combination of overfeeding and feeding guides, which the companies have to put in there an average amount to feed, but people should be well educated that depending on their specific animal's situation, they may have to increase or decrease the amount from what they start with. And that what the way to do that is to weigh them. And if they start them on a diet and they're gradually gaining weight over time, you know you're feeding too much. If they're gradually losing weight over time and they're already at optimal weight, you know they're not getting enough calories. So
you just regular weighing and then adjusting, like weighing and adjusting.
Absolutely. Regular weighing, because visually you can't see small changes over a long period of time. Right. So animals can gain a huge amount of weight over 3 months, and the owner might not even because of the fur covering and so on, they might not even recognize that they've lost or gained weight, because it just happens so gradually often.
But what you touched on there just before about how people like to see their pet eating and they like to see a nice full bowl, even as vets, like I get a huge amount of pleasure from giving dogs treats, whether it's mine or whether it's ones that come into the clinic, you know, even the ones that are fat, I'm giving them a vaccination and I think I want to give them a treat because it makes me happy to see them happy. That is a big part of it, isn't it, I guess, is people feeling like they love their pet and they want to make their pet happy even though they're making them obese.
Absolutely. And the studies that have been done on treats and feeding treats to pets is it's a companion animal owner bond that you're doing. It's nothing. The dog doesn't come to you because it's hungry or needs the food. It comes to you because you offer the food and it comes for that personal contact, and it's reinforcing that bond all the time. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with using treats either just for that or for in training systems. All you've got to do is take into consideration the calorie content of those treats and deduct it from the food that you're feeding and just maybe use a bit of the food that you feed and just to take it out of its normal feeding amount. But the other thing is that then choose treats which are not high in calories. It's simple.
Do you have any recommendations there?
Well, you can use, ideally, I would use, if you can, if you're using kibble in particular as your feed, use that dry food as your treat. Then you're not interfering at all with the balance of the ration, okay? But anything which is not high in fat. So the things absolutely to avoid are high fat treats, which would include things, straight from the frying pan, for example, bacon and things like that. So, and just avoid the high fat things. Cheese is quite high in fat, it's high in protein, but it's high in fat. Obviously things like that we shouldn't be using, and go for treats which are just low in calories, and some treats will tell you what the calorie content is and you want it to be low, and don't give twice as many treats a day as you need to, just occasionally through the day, and then you shouldn't have a problem.
And I guess related to obesity, it's as they're saying, you know, up to 40-50% of dogs being overweight. From my own anecdotal experience from standing in the consultation room, you know, it must be about a quarter or a third of the animals I see appear to have some sort of skin problem. And I know a massive part of both diagnosing and managing that is changing the diet or improving the diet. I know you've got some thoughts on this about whether they're true allergies or whether it's simply having a balanced diet that supports the skin. Would you like to expand on that?
Well, the statistics are that dietary allergies in particular, I'm not talking about ATP as well now, but dietary allergies only account for 1% of all dermatoses. So it's a low number.
To be clear, that 1% of all dogs with skin problems.
Of all skin conditions, dietary allergy actually only accounts for 1% of them.
Okay, so that's tiny. And just, I've always had the perception from, years being in practice that if there is a dietary allergy, it sort of manifests in skin problems. Do dogs get GI upsets and diarrhea as part of a dietary allergy? Or
yes, they definitely do. They do. And they often get them both together.
Okay.
So a true dietary allergy requires an immune response, which it has an adverse effect on the animal in the way of gastroenteritis or itching and pruritus and so on. Now, a lot of people diagnose a dietary allergy based on a nutritional change. So you've got the animal on food, it presents with signs which could be dietary allergy. You change the diet, the signs go away. So the assumption is it's allergic to whatever is not in the food, you know, was in the food before and not in the food now. But in fact, we know that that's flawed, because if you have a dietary deficiency, like amino acids or trace elements, they can also cause, or vitamins, they can all cause the same clinical signs. You change the diet from a poor diet, imbalanced diet, to a better balanced diet, you will get the same clinical result. So a lot of people assume because you've got the clinical result, it must be an allergy. But in fact, those studies have been done on previously diagnosed allergic dogs, and it's been demonstrated that actually they didn't have dietary allergies. And we're talking about university dermatologists in America here diagnosing with allergies. They were subsequently found to actually have a nutritional deficiency that was causing the signs. But by correcting the diet to a better diet, those deficiencies were corrected.
I mean, this is fascinating because it's, you know, I always advocate feeding a really good quality, high quality brand of any type, you know, rather than the lower quality ones. But I guess it's getting sort of vets and owners to recognize that the higher quality of the food, the fewer problems are going to get in the future. Like, you're not actually saving money by buying necessarily.
Well, the problem we've got is that there is no way that a vet or a client can know what is a complete high quality diet.
And this is something you've talked on before, isn't it? This is because legally, pet food companies aren't regulated to the point where the information they give is useful. Is that right?
No, the reason is that nobody is actually overseeing and policing the self-regulation that pet food companies have on putting a declaration on the label that the food is complete. I attended a meeting when somebody from Fediaf spoke to us, a small meeting, and he told us that across Europe, including the UK, most pet food companies do not actually know what's in their pet food, because they use an open formula. And although they may have had a formula which was tested, analyzed to prove it complied with Fediaf guidelines, because they change the formula every time they put a different ingredient in, they should really redo the analysis. But most pet food companies do not do the analysis. And for many years, I, like most vets, believe that if it said complete on the label and it was a reputable company, that you could assume that that food was okay for your clients to feed, particularly if they weren't ill, through life stages and so on. But we did a study at Nottingham where we looked at the mineral and trace element analysis on pet foods, cat and dog foods in this country, and we were shocked at the results, because it turned out in terms of wet foods, only 6% of the pet foods which were declaring themselves as being complete actually met all of the Fediaf guidelines for minerals and trace elements. It was better for the dry foods, but there again, only 35% of the dry foods met all of the Fediaf guidelines. And we know that mineral and trace element deficiencies or excesses can lead to, and do lead to, signs like dermatoses. And so now I just cannot recommend any of those products unless I know that the company behind it are testing each batch to ensure it complies with guidelines every time, and are doing the basic work which all pet food manufacturers should be made to do, which is to regularly check that their product complies with Fediaf.
So that really is shocking, isn't it, that the minority of pet foods that describe themselves as complete on the label don't provide a complete diet.
And in the case of wet foods, the vast majority, but it's the vast majority, so it's 60% of the others as well.
So how do, if you're an owner or you're a vet wanting to recommend a truly complete diet, how do you go about sourcing that?
Okay, so if we're talking about a recommendation for a clinical condition, let's say like a skin problem or gastrointestinal, I would always use a veterinary product which has been demonstrated through clinical trials to work in those patients. I personally will never recommend a diet that has not been scientifically shown to work in those clinical cases. And the reason is you cannot just take another diet. Let's say, I'll give you a really good example. Loss of packaging says hypoallergenic on the label. That means absolutely nothing. It might mean that they've taken some effort to reduce the amount of protein sources in the food, which is where most of them are coming from. But it does not mean that it will work in an animal that has genuinely got a skin allergy. It does not mean that. Now, that doesn't mean to say if you put an animal onto it, it might not improve. It might, but that does not mean it's a cause and effect relationship. And that's the other problem we've got. When animals get ill, owners or vets always say, well, what's changed? And the owners are always thinking, well, I put this animal onto this food a couple of weeks ago, it must be that. Or it had a vaccination a couple of weeks ago, it must be that. Everyone wants to attribute blame for illnesses on something that's a close temporal relationship. But the truth is that it's nearly always not true that it's that change which has caused the problem. It's just easy to jump to that assumption.
So when you are working up a potential allergy, do you do tests, or do you simply change the diet in the first instance before you do
Right.
anything?
The most important thing about trying to determine whether or not something is an allergy is a complete dietary history going back before the clinical signs emerged to see if there was a change or not. I mean, if an animal has been stable on a diet for a long time, which is a fixed formula diet, that's important because if people are changing the diet, so I'll give you, when I was at Nottingham, one of my colleagues did a study looking at the species that was in pet foods compared to what was on the label. And because you can make a claim that this is a beef product if it, as long as it contains only 4% or more than 4% of beef. So there were products out there which were being claimed to be beef, but actually one analysis where, most of the protein was pork or turkey. And there's products in the marketplace which have different colored labels, but actually it's the same food in each label. But because it's got more than 4% of
Oh, I see.
beef,
So they can say it's pork or chicken or beef or lamb
yeah,
or
they just put a
that's
different
the
label
same
on with a
thing in each
different color.
one.
So they put a green label on the one and make a claim for lamb. They put a red label on one for beef and make a claim for beef. It's actually the same food in those cans. And so the consumer or the vet does not know what's in them because the vast majority of it will be animal and animal derivatives, of which they're highlighting the beef. It doesn't mean it's all beef. And so it's really difficult to know. Even if you've got the label before you, unless you've got a company who are fully open about what's actually in the food, and there are companies like that now, especially a lot of the new startups, they're coming at it, without a history of being able to change ingredients without changing labels, and they're often much more open and also using a fixed formula. So I would always recommend a fixed formula because then nothing should be changing in it.
Okay, no, that's
So
really interesting.
I have to tell you that in the study we did at Nottingham, every major manufacturer was in the frame for some of their diets did not comply. That does not mean that every brand they ran under the umbrella didn't comply, but some didn't, and some were really bad. But the take-home message from our study, we only looked at like a couple of hundred of each, but the products manufacturers that came out best in terms of compliance were the veterinary diets. They
Interesting.
were by far the best compared to supermarket diets, and the worst were raw diets were the worst in those studies. Now,
And
in fact,
by that, do you mean the raw diets that you can buy as
the commercially prepared raw diets
commercially
we tested
prepared
were the
ones, yeah.
worst of all, which wasn't a surprise for us because they're primarily meat-based, and of course, meat is very low in a lot of minerals and trace elements. So, there's no calcium in it, for example. So, we were not surprised to find there were huge problems with the raw-based diets. And a lot of the companies I know do not even test for the trace elements. They have a computer-generated formula, but they don't test for them at the end. And the other thing is, you can have a product which complies with, let's say, copper and zinc, but if the zinc levels are very high and if the copper levels are marginally within the range, the zinc will interfere with the copper bioavailability. So those animals will still develop copper deficiency, even though there's enough copper in theory in the food. And we see that all the time. If you ever see a black cat or a black dog going brown, losing its black pigmentation, that lack of pigmentation is nearly always copper deficiency, nearly always. It can be amino acid deficiency, especially in cats, but that's extremely rare. I think that's only been done experimentally.
So this is something when you look at things like essentially amino acids or different types of minerals, they all, simply having it in the ingredients list isn't enough, because it doesn't mean it's bioavailable. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Because there are other things that can interfere. So I'll give you a really good example. Certain types of, well, this is a problem for people doing plant-based foods, certain types of vegetables, particularly the crucifers, which are things like broccoli, cabbage, and so on, may have high levels of phosphorus in them and other minerals, but actually they contain them in the form of phytates, you know, linked to phytic acid. And those phytates for the cat are not broken down because carnivores lack phytase to break them down. So you can have on a chemical analysis, you can have more than enough of these minerals, but actually they're not bioavailable to the animal because it can't break them down from the raw ingredients and assimilate them.
Yes. And so, yeah, we get that in the equine world as well, where people feed biotin to improve hoof quality, but it can't actually be absorbed by the body unless you've got the right amino acids involved in it as well. So you can think you're getting a better value supplement because it says 100% biotin, but it's actually going straight through the horse without being synthesized and put down to the hoof. So, yeah, what you're saying is really interesting. So the other sort of supplements that supposedly help skin quality, things like the omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids in the right ratio, are they truly beneficial, or are they only beneficial because they're on a bad diet in the first place?
Okay, so that's a good, very good one. So the first thing is the key omega-6 essential fatty acids are essential, have to be in the diet. And there's a difference between the cat and dog, as you probably know. The cat cannot convert linoleic acid, which is the main source of a form of fat that we get in the diet. They can't convert it through linoleic to arachidonic acid. So the poor cat, being a carnivore, requires linoleic acid and arachidonic acid in particular. Now, arachidonic acid is not currently available from a vegan source. There is a form of arachidonic acid now which has been isolated from algae, but it's not available to be put into cat foods. It's only been licensed for use in baby foods, infant foods, and the company which have that product do not want to release it for animal use. Now, that means that there cannot be a complete vegan pet food on the market, but there are people claiming their foods are complete vegan, and there are other nutrients that need to be in that ration as well, which are difficult to get from non-animal sources. Now, so as far as I'm concerned, all of those vegan cat foods that are out there are not complete foods, even if they claim to be so.
So a cat could be on a food for a vegan diet for quite a while, but not suffer any obvious problems.
It might well be suffering problems, but you can't see them. So, for example, cats also require preformed vitamin A. Yeah. Now, the vegan vitamin A that goes into human foods, which dogs can use, is in the form of beta carotene. But cats cannot, they don't have the enzyme systems to use beta carotene and convert it into retinol, which is the active form of vitamin A.
Now, so although you say you can't feed a completely balanced vegan diet to a cat, is it possible to do that for a dog?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no problem about the dog. There hasn't been a problem for many years. Dogs have undergone a lot of evolutionary genetic changes which allow them to be fully vegetarian or vegan. They actually have enzyme systems that can, you know, use beta carotene, can use other things which weren't available before. So it's not a problem for the dog at all. Yeah.
And so you just need to make sure that you're buying from a decent manufacturer so what would you, if you wanted to, because there's quite a lot of motivations for feeding a dog a vegan diet, isn't it? And one of the reasons is, you know, the impact on climate change of pet ownership and pet food. And
absolutely.
And it's, there's two questions on this. It's firstly, how do you source a vegan pet food that you know is healthy? But secondly, have you done any research or up to date with any sort of knowledge about whether vegan pet food is healthier for the client, for the planet rather than the individual dog? But is there a lower carbon input in the manufacture of vegan
pet food? Yeah. Okay. So if you look at the global situation, the major authorities across the world, including the World Health Organization and so on, have made declarations that, in their opinion, having reviewed all the scientific evidence, it is desirable to move away from animal-based protein sources to plant-based protein sources because they are better for the environment in that they're more sustainable and produce less products which can damage the environment, and also that they are more healthy. The thing is, there's been a lot of hype about this as well. And in fact, the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK over the last couple of years have been taking companies to task because they keep making claims about how green they are or how sustainable they are. And the truth is, it's almost impossible to come up with an accurate figure for how sustainable an industry is, like the pet food market. There a number of papers have come out recently on pet foods and how sustainable they are and how healthy they are. But when you look at them, in terms of the global sustainability, there are fantastic figures being quoted about how many animal slaughters you'll save a year if you move your dog onto, if everyone moves the dog onto vegan foods. But, you know, when I look at those figures, there's just so many assumptions in them, and I can't reconcile the final numbers that people give you. And I tried a lot using the references that the author was using, and I could not reconcile the figures that were being claimed in the end. And similarly with the health benefits, there are a number of papers that come out recently over the last few years, and they're all flawed because they're all involving owner reports of health benefits, not veterinary, independent veterinary or clinic-based things. It's nearly all owner reports of perceived health benefits. And of course, it's a biased population that's reporting that. So there's a big issue. And I have to hold my hand up because I've actually had a paper published recently on this very topic, but I made it very clear in the paper that this was a biased group because it was only 100 guardians of vegan fed dogs, and it was bound to be biased. I tried to minimize the bias by using a Likert scale, so they had a range to make a claim for a change they'd seen in the dogs since going on the vegan food, and it did throw up a lot of very interesting positive benefits of the vegan food. So I'm not denying that that's there, but in the scheme of things, we really don't know yet. Really, what we really need is prospective large numbers of animals, controlled studies looking at health benefits, and that's not going to happen in the immediate future.
I guess what people will find reassuring though is that, firstly, if you get a good quality manufacturer, a reputable manufacturer, they will do, they can feed their dog a vegan diet healthily. That's the sort of the bottom line, isn't it? Because
so the vegan food that I did the study with, the customers, you know, which was a company called Omni, they analyze every single batch of their food, use University of Nottingham, to make sure it still meets FedEF guidelines after it's been produced. And that's what all manufacturers should be doing. It should be a requirement that they do that, to be honest with you.
That sounds sensible, isn't it? If you're sending, if you're feeding potentially tens of thousands of dogs of each batch that goes out, and you're not even sure what's in it.
Especially if they're using open formulas, they're getting ingredients from different places and different types of ingredients, different meat going in, for example. If it's, it's really important that that should be happening.
And so then the other side of the coin, this is really interesting, it's about vegan food. I guess it's almost the opposite to say that, look at raw feeding, isn't it? It's a completely different philosophy. It seemed to be more natural, perceived to be more natural by the people who often advocate for it. But it's, what are your thoughts on a raw diet as opposed to a vegan diet or a sort of general complete diet?
So to summarize, you, at the moment, I say you can't give a vegan diet unless it's got things added to it. Can't give a vegan diet to a cat. You can to a dog, no problems whatsoever. You shouldn't have any problems at all, as long as it's been properly formulated with the right types of ingredients. With the raw food, I'm going to turn it around. There are big issues about how balanced they are in the study we did. The raw diets were the worst of the lot. But apart from that, the most important thing about feeding raw, which is where I'm really passionate about, is that owners are not being told that if you feed raw food to your dog, it can be totally healthy, but it can be shedding pathogens that can kill people. And people in this country have died because of handling dogs fed raw. And lots of diseases have been reported from dogs shedding pathogens when they're healthy themselves. So irrespective of whether you wash your hands or wash down your work surfaces after handling raw foods, which helps reduce your personal risk, your dog is a major risk to humans as well as other dogs in contact and the environment, because it's shedding pathogens into the environment. For me, that's a bottom liner. And I'm really...
So just to sum that up, so I've sort of discussed this a couple of times on radio interviews and that, and my sort of summary, if tell me if you agree with this or not, is that The dogs can be fed a raw diet. They can be healthy, but there's no specific advantages to it over a really good quality, complete diet. And there are some public health risks that you don't get with the other diets. Is that a fair summary?
Well, of course, owners can feed the animal whatever they want, you know. So, of course, you can feed raw, but the chances of it being a balanced diet is almost zero, because we did another study at Nottingham where we looked at homemade rations, and we took a homemade recipe from one of the big textbooks, you know, well-respected textbook, and I gave it to six of my nurses, sent them away to make the food, and then we analyzed it, you know, with a licensed accredited center, and we were shocked at the differences between each product, each one that had been made. Even though these were qualified vet nurses, used to dealing with very positive about nutrition, used to dealing with calculations, and yet when they produced these foods, and it was all in the Derby area, they were so different and not what they were meant to be. And so you cannot rely on giving a recipe to anybody, and any owner who isn't using at least some sort of nutrition, a veterinary nutritionist, to come up with a recipe, they will not know what can and can't go into that diet to make it balanced. So the absolute vast majority of raw foods out there are not balanced. I've already told you that the vast majority of wet foods out there are not balanced for fatty acid anyway, including raw. And so there's big issues about the nutritional adequacy of them, but the most important thing is they are not safe to use. And there's currently a campaign which has been launched by some, in my view, ill-advised vets, called Raw Safe, and they're trying to promote the idea that feeding raw foods is safe. Raw meat-based foods are never going to be safe unless they have something done to them to kill potential pathogens, which we know they carry.
No, that's really interesting. I know some veterinary teams are always concerned when they know a dog is fed a raw diet, because as you say, they could be shedding pathogens, and you can have even, immunocompromised members of the vet team, at
That's
that
exactly
as
it.
well, aren't they?
If I've got time, I'll just give you two specific examples of where raw has been bad.
Sure.
One was the actual death of a person. There was an outbreak of four patients got really serious E. coli. So E. coli can be a commensal and not really harmful to people, but some of them are very pathogenic. And there's one form called Steck. And what Steck E. coli does, it can attack your kidneys and basically give you kidney failure. So there were four patients got kidney failure linked to Steck E. coli, which had been contracted from handling dogs fed raw pet food, and one of those patients died. In a previous outbreak here in Dorset, there were 30 people were infected with Steck E. coli.
So
There too,
the
that
risk
was.
is the potential consequences are very high, aren't they?
They're very high,
For virtually no perceivable
Yeah,
benefit.
I'll give you another example. There are over 100 people in America were diagnosed in an outbreak of Campylobacter, and as you know, that's foodborne disease. And of them, I think 30 of them were hospitalized. None of them died. But what was common in the history for all of them is they'd handled a puppy in the week before they were, taken ill, seriously ill. And it turned out that the puppies were all in one group of pet stores, and what they'd done was they distributed a group of puppies around the states, different 17 different states, I think, and they were carrying Campylobacter. And people who just went into the pet store and stroked the puppies, a significant number of them, like over 100, ended up with serious Campylobacter gastrointestinal signs, serious enough to go to the doctor and in some cases be hospitalized in intensive care. So that's another example of it doesn't matter how healthy the animal looks if you feed raw. There's the risk there, particularly to young children, old people like me, people on immunotherapy and so on, with immune compromise. So for me, there is no place, there is no need. Also, there is no evidence that dogs or cats need to be fed raw meat.
So why do you think the feeding of pet food is such an emotive subject? Because you'll have seen there's huge debates online. People get quite angry when you
Yeah,
discuss
they
dog
do.
food.
If you
Why do you think it, I mean, look, ignoring the kind of the reasons for and against it, why do you think people care so much about what someone else feeds their dog food?
Well, with the raw feeding, all of the vegans, they have polarized views. And they are so dogmatic about their positioning on it, for whatever the underlying reason. You cannot have a sensible conversation with the extreme view holders. You just cannot do it. And I'll give you an example in the middle. I had a client when I had my own practice, and she bred West Highland White Terriers. And when I asked her, when the puppies were brought in for vaccination, what are you feeding your pups? Because they were weaned by the time I vaccinated. We did them at 12 weeks then. And she said, I feed them raw liver. And I said, yeah, what else? He said, no, I feed them raw liver. And you know, as you probably know, raw liver is absolutely one of the worst things you can feed as an exclusive ration to a young growing puppy, because the vitamin A levels are stacked way above toxic levels. And you will get hypervitaminosis A and skeletal abnormalities if you feed that. So I had tried to have a conversation with her and say, look, this isn't good for your puppies, you know. And she said, well, they're healthy. I said, well, they look healthy. I said, but let me x-ray the skeletons and so on. She wouldn't have any investigations done. And she was absolutely adamant that what she'd been doing for years was okay for her kittens. For her puppies. And clearly it wasn't okay for her puppies. But you just can't enter into a sensible conversation who's so entrenched in their views.
I guess it's trying to bridge the gap where, you know, everyone thinks that their motivation is to have a healthy animal, isn't it? And they've made their decision out of love for their pets and for what they believe is the best thing. And I always find that if you start from that point, you can often start to have at least find that's the common ground, isn't it? Whether you're vets, whether you feed raw food, whether you feed vegan food, you all want the animal to have a healthy life. And I guess that's something we can all try and agree on before we start any conversation going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it was easy to make a complete ration at the extreme, so the guys, the people who want to feed a raw meat-based diet compared to the people who want to feed a vegan, both those extremes of opinion on what they want to feed their animals raise really serious issues for them trying to make it a complete ration to meet all the FEDIAF nutritional guidelines. It's very difficult at those two extremes. You've got to add things in to do it. And then in middle of the road, it's much easier if you're going to go for an omnivore diet. That's much easier because you can mix and balance, you know, meats and animal-derived products and vegetables and so on. But then it still has to be done properly.
Well, that has been a very interesting discussion, Mike. We've discussed everything from obesity to what potential allergies, which might just be diet related, to the legality around sort of whether pet foods writing complete on their diet when it's not a complete diet, and vegan food, raw feed, and homemade diets. So we've covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
What would be your take home message for someone who says to you, you know, leaving ideology aside, as an RCVS specialist in nutrition, you know, what should I feed my dog?
So in relation to the veterinary profession who might listen to this broadcast, I would say try to follow WSAVA guidelines and to owners, try to look at the WSAVA website, which is wsava.org, and go to the nutrition section and look about what they say about how to pick a diet. And there are some criteria in there, which we've already touched on, about the good things about a pet food manufacturer, what they couldn't be doing. So I would recommend that, and try to use a company where you know that the quality of what they're doing is high, that they're prepared to invest in, you know, analysis of the food after every batch. Well, especially every batch if they're open formula, and also if they're prepared to invest in some way studies linked to their food. Have they done studies to check what the digestibility of the food actually is, rather than basing it on theoretical numbers based on the ingredients and so on? And if you can satisfy yourself about that, I would definitely avoid feeding foods where claims are being made which are patently pushing the bounds of probability that they're correct, because there's so many websites out there now making claims which actually are false. But, you know, advertising standards will not interfere unless someone specifically complains about them. So, you know, that should be happening a lot more. And we just need people to try to come together on it. But I'm afraid in this market, it's so diverse, you're never going to get everybody agreeing on everything. But yeah, the profession and owners need to take it very seriously, because a lot of animals out there, a lot of the common things we see, all the skeletal abnormalities we see are linked in one way or another to diet. It's not just genetics. And it's time that everybody woke up to that.
That is really helpful advice. Thank you, Mike. And thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate having you. And we might have you on again
Yeah,
and discuss
thanks,
more of
Danny.
these specific subjects in more detail, because I'm sure we'll get a lot of questions about it. But thank you.
Thank you.